What is this discontent? Birth, old age, sickness, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, despair. Being apart from the pleasant and being with the unpleasant and not getting what we want. In brief, summing it all up, grasping body and mind, holding on to this limited body and mind is suffering. There is this noble truth of the origin, the source of discontent. And what is this source? It is thirst, craving, in the Mahayana tradition, when they talk about the Four Noble Truths, they expand this and they don't just emphasize the craving aspect, but they say greed, hate, and delusion, craving, aversion, and delusion or confusion. And actually, they emphasize the delusion part. In the early sutras of the Buddha, they emphasize the craving part. In the later Mahayana tradition, speaking about the second truth, the root of actual craving and thirst and aversion is emphasized, which is delusion or misunderstanding of the way things are. It seems to me that this is getting closer and closer to the source. It's looking at not only the origin of discontent, but the origin of the origin. If the origin of discontent is craving, what's the origin of craving? It would be this misunderstanding, fundamental ignorance, subtle and deep, widespread, all-pervading, almost undiscernible misunderstanding. And there is this noble truth of the cessation of discontent, the ending of the discontent, leaving contentment, peace, and there is this noble truth of the way that is the cessation of discontent. The path, the way, the middle way. Including, first of all, the right view. Correct understanding that counteracts misunderstanding of the way things are. So first of all, right view as a factor of the path. And last of all, right view. So we start with an idea about right view. We start with this contemplating the Four Noble Truths on the path, and this culminates in the actual experienced right view. And in the middle, between right view and right view, is is the way that we live our life in accord with such view. This would include bodhisattva precepts and the ways we interact with each other harmoniously in this dreamlike world. The way that we actually are living is several of the folds of the Eightfold Path. And then the rest is concentrating, focusing the mind, settling the mind closely on these teachings. And so, again, the cessation of discontent is defined as the cessation of the origin of discontent. This is this, you know, simple logic, again, to remove the effect, to remove the cause. And one might think, well, the way to end discontent or suffering is especially, for example, to take the version of suffering is, as the Buddha defines it in one of these various definitions, it's not to get what one wants is discontent. So you think another form of logic might be, well, then to get what you want would be contentment. So just try to get what you want. Wouldn't that be the end of suffering? And I've thought about this quite a bit because logically there is some sense in this. and it actually seems to often work this way, doesn't it? That, I don't know. I'm suffering, I'm discontent because I'd like to, to take Sashin examples, right? I'm discontent because I'd like to move my leg. I'd like the bell to ring. Maybe I'd, I'm not going to maybe move it before the bell, but I'm really discontent, and it's based on not getting what I want, and not getting what I want is for the bell to ring to end the period so I can move. And then the bell rings at some point, and we get to move, and there is, we get what we want, actually, right? And discontent is, if not greatly, if not, you know, gone, it's at least greatly diminished. Doesn't it seem to work that way, right? Like, what a relief at the end of a long sitting period. Ah. So there is, in some sense, a cessation of suffering at that point. But we might, you know, be suspicious of this story, like, well, wait a second, then if so, we should just always try to get what we want and then we'll be free from suffering. And in fact, I think this logic, this very kind of sensible story is basically how the world generally operates. The whole human race and society is built on this principle, actually. The American nation is built on a life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You could say the pursuit of happiness is a little bit like the pursuit of the end of unhappiness. And we're free to pursue happiness and free to try to get what we want, and especially in a democratic society, right? It's in a capitalist society, it's based on free enterprise, and we're able to actually try to get what we want. So I think this is deep in our value system, how this works. And I wouldn't deny that there is some effect of relieving discontent. There is some truth in here, and it does work to some extent, which is why the world has gone on in such a way for so many eons, because it does kind of work. But the problem is that it doesn't completely work. Yeah, it doesn't completely work, as we know. Because we can't always get what we want. We can't always, things don't always work out that way. Conditions don't always line up to go the way we'd like them to, and therefore the discontent remains. So we could say, well, what about combining these two approaches? Combining the trying to get what we want, and then if it doesn't work out, then try the Buddha's approach of just looking at the root source of that the wanting something we don't have is the what can be let go of. And maybe in a way we do combine these approaches, I think. Maybe okay to combine these. And then I think also a time like Sesshin, like this, is a time that we might wonder sometimes why we're doing this, right? In period after period, painful bodies and painful minds. And but this is one story about this, is that it's just having this, once in a while, having a time like this where we actually, maybe in a way we're still combining the approaches because we have bells to end the periods. That's the approach of like, that we get, we set up the Sesshin to get what we want by like having bells, and we have excellent meals thanks to our cook where is the cook? He must be cooking an excellent meal or something. And yet there's so much of Sesshin where we're not getting what we want, right? Physically, it makes no sense to just keep sitting here like this, and mentally too. All the things we could be doing, we have things to do in our life, and to just sit here like this, from a certain perspective. Well, from the perspective of the, you know, that getting what you want is the end of suffering, the usual way of the world. It's like completely ridiculous what we're doing. I think most people, if they looked in the window as they walked by, would think we were insane. And so Sesshin's kind of emphasizing this other way. It's like we're still maybe mixing that, we're getting a little of what we want, but not so much. And you could say, I understand that part of the design of a retreat like this, or a Sesshin, and you know, simplifying our life in this way, and difficult practice, putting ourselves in what we know is going to be difficult practice, is just, well, we could say numerous reasons, but one of the main ones I really think here is just working with these noble truths in this way, to see this other way of finding a way to be free when we don't get what we think we want. Because if we do get what we want or what we think we want, and our discontent is relieved to some extent, then we don't get to notice, we don't get to like work with this in the same way, we don't get to watch how this works. We get to watch a little bit, but I think when we're really pushed into a place of discontent in such a situation as Sesshin, then we can, it's so in our face, right? It's like either we look at the origin and really focus on the third noble truth of the cessation, coming from letting go of relinquishing the wish for it to be different. We get to really focus on that, that practice and that release, and therefore and get to see how it works. And it may be for some of us that, well, this has never actually really worked for me. It's a nice theory, but discontent doesn't really, you know, it's just too hard to let go of my wish for it to be different. And yet, it seems that this is what Sesshin is offering, one of the things it's offering. And, you know, an uncomfortable situation is offering. And soon it will be over and we'll have comfortable more comfortable, slightly more. See, part of the thing too is that it'll continue to be uncomfortable, but just like a little uncomfortable, so we don't maybe notice it so much. And therefore we won't be so kind of pushed into looking at this third and fourth noble truth, which are, this is such a gift. The Buddha's greatest gift, maybe we could say. And then we might wonder, well, what about to say, well, just let go of the wish for things to be different, just let go of the second, and therefore the first noble truth. Well, what about, you know, what's the way? And, well, there's the whole Eightfold Path that, you know, I'm not really bringing up so far. And we may know that, you know, these practices of basically virtue, concentration, and wisdom. And yet, so in Sesshin, I'm emphasizing the wisdom part, the right view, the like really looking at the understanding, which again, as I mentioned yesterday, the right view circles back. Right view is understanding the Four Noble Truths. So the path to understand, the path to the end of suffering is understanding suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the path. And what is the path? It's understanding suffering, origin, relief, and path. And so we have some Zen stories in our tradition with the Four Noble Truths disguised within them in all kinds of infinite volumes of Zen stories. Very rarely does the topic of the Four Noble Truths come up, but it's hidden all throughout. So one story, a couple of stories from that are early Zen ancestors in China. You might have heard these stories, and if so, see if you can see them in the light of the Four Noble Truths and as a practice for today. And as usual, Zen stories are so sparse. They don't give you very much to go on. They don't give you eight whole folds of a path. They just give you like one thing. So Bodhidharma was sitting in his cave for 9 years, facing the wall at Shaolin, which incidentally, this is the origin of our sitting facing the wall, is to celebrate Bodhidharma's facing the wall of his cave, facing the unmoving wall till the mind becomes a wall, just a flat wall where if anything lands on it, it just slides right down and off. Sliding down the wall. We just face such a wall. Meanwhile, Hueka, who later would become the second ancestor, was basically suffering. He was a human being and he was suffering. And he was, we don't know if it was more or less than us, but I have this sense that like, actually, he was actually a really suffering kind of guy. Hueka. He was, you know, had to go to some extremes because of his deep discontent with his life. And we don't know the details in ancient history, but he, I think, had tried many things trying to get what he wanted, and it wasn't working out. So he was getting ready to give up, but then he heard about this teacher, Bodhidharma, who had some kind of practice to offer to free us from suffering. So he came and knocked on the door of the cave, but Bodhidharma didn't answer. And this was in the winter, and the snow is piling up around the mountain cave, and Hueka stood in the snow, piling up around him, waiting for Bodhidharma. And I think this, we could say, this is because he was suffering so much. Why would you stand in the snow waiting for this like rude person just facing the wall who won't even answer you? I don't think you could do that unless you were like really suffering. You're really discontent. Otherwise you'd just be like, I don't need this. I'm going home. But like, no, I've actually tried going home. I've tried doing everything and it doesn't work. So I'm going to wait here. And Bodhidharma said something like, you know, this way to the end of suffering takes incredible diligence and effort, and it's not for the weak-hearted or something like that, after he'd been standing in the snow for a week or something. And so, you know, as the story goes, Hueka, in a kind of extreme moment where he lost the middle way, or he didn't know the middle way yet, I think this was the problem. And so he, to kind of prove his sincerity, he cut off his arm and offered it to Bodhidharma. And this point, Bodhidharma's, okay, okay. I can almost maybe even imagine Bodhidharma's like, oh no, I should have like talked to this guy earlier. Now he's gone way too far. Like, oh no, you should not have done this. Because you're concentration mudra will not work so well anymore. but also they, you know, in Zen they celebrate this still. They even have the Soto Zen ceremony for, I think it's like just before Rohatsu Sesshin is like, or just after, it's sometime in December where they have like the something like that. A severing the arm ceremony, something like this, to kind of like honor the I think what it is, it's honoring is like the total devotion of this disciple of Bodhidharma, that, you know, and we don't know if this even really happened or not, right? But, and it's so extreme that it's disturbing. And yet, I think it's, even if someone made it up, I think they made it up to kind of like push at our ideas of like how, basically like make us question our devotion to practice. Maybe this is what it does. That's what it does for me. Anyway, yeah, Weka came to Bodhidharma with his arm. And so Bodhidharma said, Bodhidharma let him in, or, and maybe had him face the wall for a while. And at some point, Weka said, my mind is not at peace. I am an anxious guy and I'm suffering. Please pacify my mind for me. Please give me the third noble truth of the cessation of this suffering mind. And Bodhidharma said, well, bring me your mind and I'll pacify it. Right. And so Weka said, well, when I look for my mind, I can't find it to bring you. And Bodhidharma said, I've pacified it. And it worked. Weka's mind released its wish for anything else, and it was pacified. So this is a Zen story that we could take up as a meditation today. If we feel our mind is not pacified, look for our mind, our unpacified mind, as we, to, you know, to pacify it, we would first need to find it and find where its unpacified quality. We have to find the unpacified quality to pacify it. So look for that. And if we look very carefully, we may not be able to find it. And then this is the question, if this is a new story for you, what is this about? The fact that you can't find your mind is the pacification of your mind. And to insert this into the Four Noble Truths, we could say, to not find the suffering mind, to not find the discontent, like really find it in some tangible way, we could pick it up, to not be able to find that, to locate it, to be able to grasp actually the discontent, is the pacification, the cessation of the discontent. Then the second ancestor practiced with Bodhidharma and passed his Dharma on to the third ancestor, who, as the story goes, had leprosy. The third ancestor had leprosy, which I don't know is how common that is in China. And there's various stories about his suffering too. All his life, apparently, third ancestor had leprosy. And he's the one who wrote, later in his life, the song of trusting the mind, which starts, the way is not difficult. The middle way is not difficult for those who hold no preferences, with no picking and choosing. Which is also, you could say, that line is a Zen version of the beginning of this first sutra of the Buddha, which strikes me now as kind of amazing. almost like maybe this was actually maybe more than just coincidence, that they say this is like the first Zen poem in a way, the first officially Zen teaching. And the very first line of the first teaching is, the way is not difficult for those who hold no preferences, which means like extreme, like I want this or I want that. They don't hold either, a wish for this or that. They let go of that and they find they enter the middle. And the beginning of the Buddha's very first teaching was, there's this middle way that's not difficult for those who don't indulge their wishes for things to be a certain way, and those who don't go to the other extreme and punish themselves for indulging their wishes. Something like this. Any extreme views or practices are painful. So then the third ancestor was practicing not having a preference for no leprosy. and then the fourth, and what was to become the fourth ancestor, came along, Daoxin, and very similar to the story about Huayca and Bodhidharma, similar kind of principle, said, please, Songsan, third ancestor, give me a way to liberation. Give me a practice, give me the way, give me a path to the cessation of suffering. I like the word liberation. I use a lot in terms of, instead of enlightenment or something like this, and liberation could have many meanings. Liberation or freedom, emancipation, all synonyms. But really, I think mainly it refers to liberation from suffering. So please give me a path, a way, leading to liberation from discontent. Again, this is so Four Noble Truths in woven through these Zen stories. And in this case, the third ancestor says, well, who's binding you? You want to be free? You want to be liberated? Who's binding you? You know, bondage is the opposite of liberation. What, you want to be free from bondage, free from the bondage of discontent? Well, who's binding you? And the Daoxin said, well, nobody's binding me. And then third ancestor said, well, then why are you seeking liberation? And this was the fourth ancestor's moment of great liberation. He entered liberation. He entered the cessation of discontent. So it's a little bit different nuance than pacify my mind. Well, bring me your mind and I'll pacify it. Oh, I can't find my mind. It's kind of similar in this case of give me a way to liberation. Well, who's binding you? In this case, he says, nobody's binding me. He doesn't say, well, I can't find one who's binding me after looking. It's maybe quite clear right from the beginning. He maybe immediately answers, well, there's nobody else binding me. And then the question comes back. Well, if nobody's binding you, then why are you seeking freedom? What are you seeking freedom from if nobody's binding you? So two different twists on a similar theme that is the way to work with the third and fourth noble truth in the Zen school. as this may be the last talk, depending on if anybody's around tomorrow. Does anyone have anything to ask about or to bring up? To you know.
You mentioned discontent about sitting. Mm. There seems to be a different kind of discontent. There's discontent that's sitting, but I know somewhere someone's going to ring that bell, and they're going to solve my discontent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But for me, it would be discontent where I don't see a solution, and it's something I want, but I don't know how to get it. That seems more of a arise discontent of me, not knowing I can get it.
So, but still, at the time that you're maybe when you're actually practicing with it, it's not that different, because like when you're sitting there waiting for the bell, you're like, well, I will be discontent in the future, but right now there's no ending of this discontent. I mean, maybe what you're saying is the difference is this hope for the, like a well-justified hope for the future that the bell is going to ring, kind of decreases my discontent. Like I can just wait it out.
Right, yeah.
I can wait it out, which maybe would be like not as valuable a practice in the sesshin context of like, well, let me just bear it till the bell rings. That wouldn't be so useful in terms of investigating the Four Noble Truths as it would be like, well, while I'm here waiting, instead of just waiting it out, like let's actually look really deeply, like can I actually release the wish so that actually when the, you know, and sometimes this happens, I think maybe people have this experience in sesshin where it's like you're really wanting the bell to ring, and then you really do look at like, okay, what's going on? Okay, let go. And then you're just really settled, and 5 minutes later it's like you're just praying the bell won't ring, because right? You're like, oh, this is just like, don't end, you know. Sometimes this happens. But yeah, these cases, I think it's the same meditation though, of when you know there will be no end to it, no relief at the end, it's still like, right now I'm discontent, and like, you know, without thinking about the future relief or non-relief, just like, can I let go of this wish for it to be different? That seems the main thing. Because it's, and maybe in a way, maybe it's easier to do this practice when there isn't a bell at the end, you know, because it's like there won't be the relief of like, you know, I want the cookie and eventually I'm going to get the cookie, so the suffering's not as, the discontent's not as bad, but like I'm never going to get the cookie, so then I have to just, the only way to be free then, actually, right, is to actually, like, can I actually let go of the wish for the cookie? So this sounds funny maybe, but kind of like in the same spirit of how I'm sort of saying, the advantage of something like a sesshin is really great for practicing with this stuff, that a situation where there's really no, won't be a relief in the usual sense of the way the world wants reliefs. Like, and a common one is like the fact that we're all going to die, for example. Here's one we all have to practice with, that there's no way out of this one. There's no way out of this one. So can we actually to some extent, can we actually not wish to live forever? Or, you know, somebody else, the wish for somebody else to live forever or something like this. Those are, I think, like in a way the biggest ones that we know will never go another way, right? We'll know there'll never be the usual relief and like that we get exactly what we want. Does that make sense? So it's still like the point of this Four Noble Truths thing is like, actually has very little to do with like the way actually things work out or not work out. It's like, I think that's maybe a nice point to remember, is that it really doesn't matter if you're really immersed in this like cessation of suffering thing. It's like it could go either way, This is maybe also not having preferences. It's like sometimes it works out. Sometimes you get the cookie and sometimes you don't. And like, either way, it doesn't really matter in terms of the cessation of suffering, because it's like, it's just like you're not wishing for it to be one way or the other. And I think in a way you could say, as the sutra is talking about, self-mortification would be like you're trying to go the other way, and you're trying to like, I'm going to practice like not getting what I want in an extreme way, and just to like prove something or whatever. But that's actually wishing. In a way, you could say that's wishing for something that is not happening now too. Like at all these practices that they did in Buddha's time, that you find in these old sutras, like amazing. That the Buddha would kind of make fun of, actually, like people would stand on one foot and like with holding an arm in the sky and not whip, you know, for 5 years or something. Just ascetic practices. And they still do this stuff in India. There's still these practices. And there's one sutra called the Dog Duty Ascetic. And it's quite humorous sutra, actually, and maybe mentally a little humorous. That it's all these various practices people are doing, and one of them is acting like a dog, like literally, dog duty. And they would do this, apparently this is a real thing, they would walk around on all fours, naked, and they couldn't use their hands to eat. So they would like eat out of bowls with their mouth. And this was, sounds strange, but I think these were probably very, very sincere people, actually, who were like, we are, you know, trying to overcome our, basically, attachment to eating with our hands, maybe, and to walking on two legs. And so we're kind of like, we don't want to be like, indulgent by, you know, using our hands to eat. So let's, just, you know, crawl around and eat off the ground. And probably these things do lead to some, you know, it kind of like tame the mind to some extent. You know, if people are like really into eating out of a really nice bowl or something, then they get over that attachment. I think that's what it's about. But the Buddha's like, would kind of say, basically the effect of this practice is that you'll probably be just, next life you'll be born as a dog, and you're creating the conditions for dogness, and it won't really lead to the cessation of suffering, which is probably why you're doing it, but there's only one way to the cessation of suffering, which is understanding how it works, basically. So maybe possible to be dog duty ascetic if you understand that you're not trying to actually get anything from it. This is the main thing. It's just giving up trying to get anything from anything. Yeah.
Stage where we learn how to modulate our stress.
Mm.
You know, we start learning patience, we start delaying gratification. And of course, there's people that are wounded very young that don't learn that and have, you know, real difficulties for the rest of their life.
Mm.
But, you know, at what point is just learning patience, is learning how to, you know, the end of the world isn't coming if our parents say, you know, dinner's going to be 10 minutes late, or we're having dessert tonight, and stores closed.
Mm-hmm.
At what point does it become a spiritual practice? Saving all beings, is saving all beings?
Interesting point, actually, yeah, because we do actually learn that, yeah, and like, yeah, little kids are just like, mine, give me what I want now. And it's like, you know, yeah, that we learn to modulate it. Society with all its, you know, problems, you know, painting this kind of bleak picture of people misguidedly trying to get what they want and forgetting about this, the path. Still, I think this is a way that society actually works quite wonderfully, and that people do actually learn to be patient and learn to, like, that is kind of a letting go for the kid to say, oh, okay, I can let go of that. I don't need that toy right now, or something. I think we could call that a type of spiritual practice, because definitely patience is a spiritual practice in itself. And yet, I think it steps on the way, but it wouldn't be exactly the cessation of suffering. It wouldn't be really understanding this principle. It's related, I think, closely related maybe, but I think this Four Noble Truths principle applies to all kinds of subtleties. And as I mentioned the other day, like, particularly, like, not just like, oh, I can't have that toy, but like, I think probably for most of us, and especially in the modern Western world, most of our discontent is not about not having the right toys and stuff, but actually the ways we think about ourselves and, like, you know, psychological suffering, I think, is much deeper. And maybe this is true of all cultures too, but maybe there's simpler societies where they're more survival based, and maybe they don't have as much psychological issues because they're actually just trying to survive another day. It might be the case, but in a way, that's maybe the blessing and curse of our modern well off society, is that we get a lot. Our lives are not so threatened physically, that we get to look more deeply at this other stuff that maybe is underlying all humans. But when we take care of the gross stuff, then we can look at these other factors. And so, this seems like something a little deeper than just patience. Although patience goes a long way, maybe would solve
80%.
Yes. I think so, maybe. And then this last 20 is like, and even the last 20, it's like we might be like, as practitioners, as serious Zen practitioners who are doing a sesshin, right? We already are working with this stuff, I'm sure, in our lives. And that's maybe another, you know, now we're up to 92%. So it's like, I think this, as we get closer to the last percentages, It's like the curve, the peak gets higher and higher and steeper and steeper. I've heard one story about like the design of this kind of altar is, this is a traditional altar where it's like built on, like, there's these steps down below that go like that, and then it goes up, and then the steps that go kind of out again, goes in and then out, and sometimes they're called Mount Sumeru altars, and it's like the Shumidan is like the center of the universe, Mount Sumeru, and it's like this, and Buddha's at the top, so Buddha's on the top of the altar, right? And so we're at the bottom climbing up to Buddha, and so far we start climbing the hill up like this, and then as we get closer to Buddha, it gets steeper and steeper. It's like the hill is steeper until we're like, actually, as we get very close to the top, we're like backwards, like hanging off the rock, scaling up there. So this image comes to mind for like the last few percents of, you know, our little bits of like, well, actually, maybe even in sesshin, I'm kind of like, at some point, maybe we're just coasting along, like, now I'm settled into the sesshin body and mind, and going with it, and yet there's these last percents of like, but still this gnawing, you know, stuff, or else it's like things are really cool, and then like Orioki Mio comes and like, let's change the whole, like, let's do it on the floor. Like, I could see like my settled mind was going like, but this, but that, but that. So, you know, these things are great. And then percentage maybe like goes way back up again. Yes.
I this always, you know, make me think of people with chronic pain, because you know, in my own experience, you can you know, I can spend a lot of time trying to get out of pain, and a lot of resources trying to get out of pain, not just time but energy and effort and getting in more pain to get out of pain, all sorts of weird things. And you know, so sometimes I sit, sometimes I lie down for zazen, and you know, when I first learned about lying down postures, I thought, great, you know, I'm going to be able to do zazen without pain.
No suffering at all.
No. Guess what? Pain in every position.
Mm-hmm.
It's just different pain, more pain getting up. So essentially, what I've come to understand about this is that at least my current, you know, wherever I am on that path, if I continue only to put my energy on seeking relief, then I just end up feeling chased by my pain. And my pain catches me. It will always catch me. It catches me every time. So I'm trying to learn, you know, to include more in my effort, include more in my attention, so that, because I can't get away from pain, so what I can do is include more than the pain. Try to broaden, simultaneously include more. And
like what more?
Like sound.
Okay.
The feeling of the air,
coolness,
heat, or the sound of someone breathing near me, or someone coughing, or moving, or the smell of the incense. Or, I mean, I'm just talking.
It's like a wider mind.
Widening, as wide as I can get it, because otherwise, it's hardly a life worth living in a lot of ways. I mean, it's just either chasing or being chased all the time. And so I guess what I'm wondering is, in terms of the Four Noble Truths, you know, how would you relate that to this to this experience?
Yeah. Well, interesting practice too, because I think, and it may work this way for you, but I think of as a this kind of expanding the awareness to include more could also include some new understanding of how the pain fits into like the larger whole. So there could be you could say that could include something like part of right view that's maybe not, you know, stated this way exactly in the sutra, but we could state in maybe more Zen-like terms the right view that actually the whole interdependent universe, we're like widening the view to include everything, where now the pain in this body is just this one little part, maybe big part of it seems to us at the time, but maybe becomes a smaller and smaller part as the awareness gets bigger and bigger, and then it has its place. And so it's not, it's like there's nothing in the universe but this pain. It's like, oh no, there's this huge world out all around. And then within that, there's what I call this body and mind, and this pain within this body and mind. So that could be like part of path. in a kind of different way than that, that traditional version, maybe. But
so putting the pain on a in a broader field.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and seeing the nature of the pain too. But that's what I could see, that that broader field starts to be like the pain is now just, it's connected with this larger whole, and it's, when I think of that, that wider awareness, it's more like opening to actually how everything is connected to everything, if it gets really wide, and how everything is dependent on everything else. And then we see how the pain is just another part of this interdependent universe, and therefore that's like kind of like looking at the nature of the pain, which goes back to these Zen stories about like, well, bring me your pain and I'll relieve it. And like, oh, like actually I can't find it anymore. It's not this small little thing I thought it was. It's just part of this whole, and I can't actually get a hold of it to bring it anymore. It's part of a larger field, and this could be the end of suffering, the end of our limited version of that pain. It's like it becomes ungraspable. If that makes any sense. The pain becomes less and less like grasping as like, this is my pain and I gotta get rid of it. More like, as it gets bigger and bigger field, it could be more like, actually I don't even know what it is anymore. It's not like there's nothing there, but I can't define it in the same way. It's very mysterious, actually. And maybe at some point, people might have this experience in Sesshin of like really focusing on a physical sensation and really exploring like, what is it? You know, sometimes you might, if you haven't done this, I recommend like really very experientially, like, what is, oh, it's pain in my butt. Like right now I feel it's butt. So it's like, oh yeah, it's just that. And if I just think about it on the surface, it's like, yeah, it's the pain in the butt. But then actually, well, what is it? And particularly about the pleasant, unpleasant thing, I think it's very interesting because of course it's unpleasant. It's painful, like it's so obvious. But what does that mean? And like, well, there's this strong nerve thing happening down here. But like, why am I immediately labeling it as unpleasant? I mean, it's so obvious, and yet like, is it really unpleasant, or what is unpleasant anyway? And if you're quite focused, quite present, and really exploring it in a very like just receiving the experience, I find it starts to break down what pleasant and unpleasant is. It starts to become like, actually, it's kind of, I don't know what it, I don't, why am I calling it unpleasant? It's, I wouldn't call it pleasant either, but like, it's indefinable kind of sensation, and then there's something amazing about that. And I find if it's a very concentrated thing, and if the mind veers off for a second, even if it's like if somebody coughs or something, and then I'm like, I'm not so focused on that point, it'll be right back to like, oh no, it's pain. I wonder what. I don't know if you have that experience. It's a very, you know, attending really carefully to a sensation where it, for maybe a moment or two, it's like it's beyond pleasure and pain, but it's not that there's nothing there. But
I was, through this period I was kind of working with maybe one line I read, some things about the posture and Zen mind, beginner's mind, and there's a thing. Right after that, there's mind waves or mind weaves, these little paragraphs, and he says, usually we think that our mind receives things from outside and bring them in, but this is not so. Your mind makes everything. And that one little phrase had been churning, and your mind makes everything, and then trying to stop kind of the manufacturing of the mind, and then really wondering, you know, for example, the breath going in and out, am I drawing in breath, or is, you know, is the world pushing into me, and I'm, you know, sort of the opposite. Like the outside is the lung, and I'm like the air, mm-hmm. if you will. You know what I mean? Because your mind maybe even manufacturing mm-hmm. all these distinctions.
And that whole image is a mind made.
Is a mind made, exactly. Yeah. Working with these sort of things, but I think it does come up in the context of some physical pain in that sort of where. You know, is it stimulus coming outside that is creating this, or my mind actually, in essence, manufacturing this pain? Where in if I'm all one in the universe, so to speak, and I'm not making these distinctions, what is pushing on me that's causing it? You know, I was almost thinking, you know, what is pressing onto my knees? Is it anything? You know what I mean? You know, just rather than, you know, conceptualizing it in a way that, well, pain, all these different things that are, you know, that our brains do compartmentalize. But I don't know, a lot of times you get a little elaborate in discussing this, but so that's fascinating, the mind manufacturing everything, the mind makes everything, and that's very similar to what you're discussing in a way.
Yeah, definitely. That actually pain needs a mind.
And the next comment was, nothing outside can harm me, though. That's interesting. Yeah, so everything is inside that's hurtful.
Or we usually say inside because that's where we think mind, but actually, maybe more accurately, mind is not like the same as the brain, for example. Mind has no location, according to Bodhidharma, right? Because like, well, and Weka, bring me your mind and I'll pacify. Well, I can't find my mind. It's not inside or outside, but that actually mind, which maybe that helps, that it's not inside or outside, to open to the way that mind is actually creating everything, or in terms of our experience, which is all we have to go on anyway, is our own experience. We definitely can say that, like, and this is the premise of this whole mind-only school, is that it's like taking that understanding and really like getting into all the nuances of how basically the way we experience everything is just through the lens of our own mind and perception and other mental factors. But it's not to say that there's like, well, this gets hard to talk about, but that there's like, that there's no, you know, there's nothing at all here. It's just that in terms of our experience, we can't actually know if there's something objective out here. So we don't, almost like the Buddha Dharma doesn't even get into discussing like how wood is produced or something like that. It's more just like, we only are dealing with our own experience because that's where suffering comes from, and if it's only about suffering and the release of suffering, then in our experience, well, what's, you know, it seems like there's wood here, but actually the mind is making it wood, and the mind's making it pain even more, maybe easy to see that the mind is creating the pain, and yet it's not like we're in control of that either, right? Like the mind, obviously, oh, the mind is making the pain. I think I'll stop now. It's that everything is conditioning everything, and yet it's all being filtered through this particular mind. But the fact that it's being filtered through this particular mind means that that's the great potential for freedom, though, is because that's completely workable. The mind is completely flexible at its, you know, in its nature. It can learn different ways of seeing things. It's changing all the time. And so this is maybe the basic premise of practice in the first place, is that, well, wood, we can't change the nature of wood exactly. We can change some things in the world to help, and that's part of our practice too. And but in the meditation practice, it's like we're not dealing with the external world or manipulating the external world. We're just seeing how we're creating it, Yeah, those are great teachings to see how they work in your practice. So we'll continue not finding anything, dedicating the merit to the unfindability of all beings. Beings are numberless, I vow to save them. The illusions are inexhaustible, I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless, I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.